Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Okay, well, good morning. Here I have a note of what's going on December 1st. And it seems that we have at 9:45 Wanakee High School students. If that's correct, would they and their advisors please stand? Very good. My goodness, you're a big group. Thank you. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class, so they've had the opportunity to have the briefs and to learn a little bit about the cases that you all are going to argue before us today. If they can stick around until we finished our second case, so probably be about 12:10, 12:15, Justice Shirley Abraham's son, who generally sits here but is on the phone, will meet with you and talk with you a little bit about matters that go on at the Supreme Court procedure-wise, not the substance of the case that we are about to hear. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, I am Barrett Van Sicklin of DeWitt Ross and Stevens, and along with my partner, Donald Leo Bach, I'm proud to be before you today representing the taxpayers, Tetra Tech, and Lower Fox River remediation. Review was taken in this case to consider two issues. The first issue is whether the services here should be taxed as processing under Wisconsin Statute 77.52, sub 2A 11. For purposes of review here, it is the decision of the Tax Appeals Commission, not the Court of Appeals, that is subject of review. We are requesting the court reverse and set aside the commission's decision and hold that the taxpayers are not liable for tax. When reviewing the commission's interpretations previously, courts have afforded one of three levels of deference: great weight, due weight, or no weight. And this standard of review is at the heart of the second issue before the court today. The court asked the parties to address whether or not the practice of deferring to agency interpretations of statutes comports with Article 7, Section 2 of Wisconsin's Constitution. The practice of deferring to agency interpretations of statutes violates Wisconsin's Constitution and is also inconsistent with agency review under Chapter 227. In our case, as the poster child for changing the court's deference approach. Here, the agency made a policy decision when it chose to tax an activity which is a court or an ordered environmental remediation activity that the legislature never intended to tax.
Counsel, could we focus right off the bat on the structural question of deference? The Department of Revenue is not arguing that great weight deference is consistent with our Constitution, so really our focus here appears to be on due weight deference.
Right? Correct. It's I would agree that the Department is aligned with us in that their view is that great weight deference violates the Constitution.
All right. So if we're addressing due weight deference, let's look at this way. Department of Revenue suggests that the right of judicial review of an agency determination is a matter of legislative grace, that the case can come here because the legislature says it can, right?
Chapter 227 review is the statute that applies to agency review.
Right.
Yes.
So if the legislature says this is the way it can come to the court, can the legislature also say these are the confines within which the court may decide the questions?
Here, Chapter 227 does not provide for due weight deference. There is nothing in Chapter 227 that suggests that courts give agency interpretations due weight deference.
Okay, then maybe you could help me out a little bit on the meaning of Section 227.57 sub 10, which, as you know, says upon such review, referring to judicial review, Due weight shall be accorded the experience, technical competence, and specialized knowledge of the agency involved. What does that mean?
Giving due weight deference to an agency's specialized knowledge, technical competence, and experience is a lot different than giving due weight deference to an interpretation of statute.
All right, so tell me how that differs.
Well, if we look at 227 sub 0.57 subs 3, subs 5, and subs 8, each of those subsections calls the court to give, to treat questions of law differently than factual determinations. Each of those subsections calls the court to give questions of law independent judicial review. And so here, when you're dealing with just solely an issue of agency's interpretation of a statute, it's subject to independent judicial review. And courts, when they defer to an agency's interpretation of statutes, it's not consistent with the Constitution, and it's also not consistent with Chapter 227 review. And why we don't give review is personified by this case. The tax here is unique. It's selective and limited in nature, and that only the services that are clearly and expressly set forth by the legislature are to be taxed. And all ambiguity and doubt is to be construed in our favor. And if we look at the subsection that's at issue here, the processing subsection 2A11, this tax was designed to tax manufacturers and producers in a commercial setting. Here, the activity is the antithesis of something commercial.
I want to get back to the question posed by my colleague and ask, how does your answer with regard to deference comport with this court's decision in Racine Harley Davidson, where we said essentially giving deference to an agency's interpretation doesn't mean that the court accepts the interpretation without giving a critical eye and review to the meaning of the statute? It goes on to say, I paraphrased that, but it goes on to say the court itself must always interpret the statute to determine the reasonableness of the agency interpretation. That's in paragraph 15. How does your response to Justice Kelly's question comport with our Racine Harley Davidson decision?
It might be useful for a court to review an agency interpretation of a statute in helping come to its own interpretation of the statute at issue, but it's something entirely different when a court gives it deference, whether it's great weight deference or due weight. Under great weight deference, the court could have an entirely different interpretation of the statute, but unless it's more reasonable than the agency's interpretation, it's not allowed to stand, and the agency's interpretation holds under deference standards. Under due weight, you know, although this court has previously said it's almost the same thing, it's not. It's still deferring to an agency's interpretation of a statute.
Except in due weight, if the court finds it less reasonable, that is, the agency's interpretation. Conversely, another interpretation is more reasonable, it'll give no deference at all.
Under due weight deference, if a court has could have a different interpretation of the statute, a completely different interpretation than an agency's interpretation. And under a due weight framework, the court would be required to defer to that agency's interpretation if it was not more reasonable. And that's inconsistent with Chapter 227. It's also inconsistent with Wisconsin's Constitution, which says that the courts of this state are to interpret statutes. And if this court finds that it's not unconstitutional or it's not inconsistent with Chapter 227, it's deference is a judicially created doctrine that this court can do away with. Frankly, it's not fair to the citizens of this state that unelected administrative agencies with administrative law judges with far less experience than the judges of this state are making decisions. The courts of this state are to be the ones interpreting the law.
Can I ask you a question just to be sure that I have the facts correct? As I understand it, there was a transfer of slurry from the Fox River by the initial dredger who put it in a tanker and took it to SDI. And nobody said there's a tax on that part between those two entities. Then SDI separated it out into three parts, into water, into sand, and into the sediment that was left after those parts were taken out. And then SDI transferred those three parts to Tetra Tech. At that transfer, there's an allegation the tax should have been paid on the service that SDI provided to the slurry. Is that correct?
Tetra Tech is paying SDI to do exactly what you said, to separate the slurry of materials brought to it. And do
right,
it.
Right. But I'm concerned. I want to be sure that I, well, you'll understand why I'm concerned after my next question. But there is a tax that DOR assessed on the transfer from SDI to Tetra Tech.
Yes.
Okay. Then at Tetra Tech has it, and they take the PCBs out of the water, put it back in the Fox River. No? Or do they transfer that on to Remediation LLC, and that's the entity that takes the PCBs out of the water?
Here's what happens. Lower okay. Fox River Remediation engaged in a contract with Tetra Tech. So
right.
Tetra Tech is the general contractor.
Right.
It engages SDI, which is the subcontractor.
Gotcha.
The slurry of materials is removed from the Fox River and brought to SDI.
Right.
At SDI, SDI's sole function here is to separate the materials it receives, right? So then it separates it into
right.
water, sand, and PCBs.
Yeah. Well, it's a sludge that's left over. Yeah.
It's a filter cake of the PCBs. So the whole purpose of SDI's function here is to separate out the PCBs so they can be taken to the landfill.
Okay.
And then it returns each of those three parts that it separated it out to Tetra Tech.
Okay.
Tetra Tech.
All right. Then what does Tetra Tech do with it?
Tetra Tech returns the water that now no longer has PCBs to the Fox River.
Don't they take the PCBs out, or did SDI take the PCBs out?
SDI separates everything it receives from the river into its component parts. One part is water, one part is sand.
I got it, but I thought the water still had PCBs, according to the briefing, and that Tetra Tech took the PCBs out of the water before it returned it to the Fox River. That's not accurate?
There might be some minimal PCBs still in it that return to Tetra Tech. Tetra Tech then removes the last, you know, tiny bits of PCBs and ultimately returns it to the river.
Okay, so it's Tetra Tech that puts it back in the river, and then I understood that the sand that was left and the sludge both had some PCBs, and the sand was donated to the highway department to use in roads because it doesn't matter if it's got PCBs? Is
no,
that correct?
The sand might have a very limited amount of PCBs in it.
Whatever.
It can't be used in a sandbox, but it's limited enough that it can be used in highway projects. But the real thing that's left is a filter cake of the PCBs.
That's fine, but okay, so you've got three things. Tetra Tech puts the water back into the river. Does Tetra Tech take the cake that's left and put it in a landfill?
Yes.
And does Tetra Tech take the sand and give it to the highway department or whatever?
Yes.
Okay. Then what I understood there was yet another tax from Tetra Tech to Remediation LLC on the services that Tetra Tech provided. Is that correct?
I don't know if I'm understanding your question.
Okay, because see, I thought there were taxes twice on services, and that's the fact I was trying to get straightened out in my own mind.
Both the LLC and Tetra Tech are being taxed. There's sales tax and use tax. So one entity is being charged with sales and one is being charged with the use tax. So Lower Fox River Remediation, the LLC, is paying Tetra Tech to undertake these activities. And so they are being taxed on that end. Tetra Tech is also being taxed for its payment to SDI for the separation services it provides. And so, did I answer the question?
No, not really.
Okay.
If this is the same process, I understood it that there were, quote, services by SDI, DOR says. So you have to pay taxes. You have to collect taxes on that, and you would collect it from Tetra Tech. That's what I understood. Then I understood there were services that Tetra Tech did. Just let me finish. And those services were paid for by Remediation LLC. Because there were additional services by Tetra Tech, there was another tax that was being that Tetra Tech should have added on to whatever they were charging Remediation, which they didn't. So you're shaking your head, so there's no other tax there.
No, the only tax at issue here deals with the activity of SDI.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Both Tetra Tech and Lower Fox are being taxed for that activity and the amount being paid to SDI to undertake that activity.
Okay, so it's the same amount. So if Tetra Tech had paid it, then Remediation LLC wouldn't have to, and if a Remediation LLC paid it, Tetra Tech didn't have to pay it, right?
No, they both had to pay a tax.
Okay, well, see, then they're paying, it's on services, and that's what I was trying to get you to help me with. Because if Tetra Tech did other services, then I want to know how those services of Tetra Tech fit in with the taxing authority. If you're all looking back to SDI, and that's the only services we're talking about taxing, I don't see how you can get taxed for the same thing two different times. That's what's concerning me.
I understand your question. My understanding of it is that Lower Fox is paying Tetra Tech to undertake these activities. Tetra Tech is then paying SDI, so it's sort of a flowback, but it's all in relation to SDI's activities. There's no tax as a result of anything done by Tetra Tech to the materials that it receives back from SDI. It all relates to SDI's function of separating out the materials.
Okay, so if Tetra Tech gets tapped for these tax, Remediation LLC is off the hook.
No, they're both being charged the tax.
Okay. You're not going to be able to collect the same tax from both, or is that what you're telling me? Yes, you are.
There's a sales tax and a use tax, and I believe
that's right.
I understand that. I understand that. But if it's just on the same activity, you're still taxing the same activity twice.
Is it a sales tax against Tetra Tech and a use tax against the Fox River Remediation, and both taxes relate to SDI's work?
Yes.
Yes, that's what I was trying to figure out. So there's no tax on anything Tetra Tech did itself. Okay. All right. Thank you. That was the problem. Thank you, Justice Ziegler.
Yep.
Thank you. And so the tax here, though, is in relation to these separation activities, which are not commercial in nature. This is not a for-profit endeavor. This is something that the parties were ordered to do, and they undertook it.
Hang on just a second on that point. This was for-profit on the part of SDI, right?
SDI makes a profit, but
right.
Lower Fox River Remediation and Tetra Tech are not making a profit. They're paying a considerable amount to have this activity undertaken.
Sure. Where is the requirement that the activity be for profit with respect to Tetra Tech or LFR?
If you look at the context of where this term appears in the statute, it suggests value-enhancing type activities. So if we look at 2A11, we're talking about producing, fabricating, printing, and imprinting. And then if we go further and look at the Department of Revenue's own rule on what it considers to be taxable processing, which is located in WIS Admin Code 1138, that's under the manufacturers and producers subsection. So only manufacturers and producers can be engaged in a processing activity. We are not a manufacturer or a producer of anything. We simply, when I say we, I mean SDI. SDI doesn't manufacture or produce anything. There's no good or product that's ultimately sold. It's the separation activity here. And if you look at 1139, right below WIS Admin Code 1138, the Department of Revenue also defines manufacturing. It defines it as the production by machinery of a new article of tangible personal property by a process properly regarded as manufacturing. What SDI does here, which is to separate everything out so that the PCBs can be brought to a hazardous landfill for proper disposal, is not a manufacturing or a production effort. It's just a simple separation process to help remove the PCBs from the river.
Council is also interested in the provision of 77.52 sub 2 sub 11 when it referred to who is providing the materials upon which these processes are done, it refers to them as consumers. Is there a definition of consumer that we should be looking at?
I'm not sure, but I don't believe that whether or not Tetra Tech or Lower Fox River Remediation is a consumer is at issue here. Tetra Tech is the consumer in this instance. The only dispute here is whether or not the service of separating out these materials is taxable.
Right. So this kind of circles back into your point about manufacturers and producers. And as I was looking at the terms of the statute, I wondered whether it was important whether the consumer owned the materials that they provided to the processor to do their process on.
It does matter.
Okay. And does Tetra Tech or LFR own the materials that were provided to SDI?
In this case, there is no dispute about this material being tangible personal property. There's no dispute that Tetra Tech is the consumer. The only dispute is whether or not the service is taxable. And so there might be exceptions to whether or not somebody, you know, owns the material or not. But if you provided a service on your own property, for instance, you can't be taxed. For instance, if I repair my own car, I'm not going to be taxed for it. Where you get taxed is when you take your car to a mechanic, and the mechanic is the one that repairs it. And that's sort of what happens here, is that Brennan is in this instance, Tetra Tech owns the property in the sense that it's the slurry of materials being removed, and that's being separated by SDI.
Well, let's perhaps not jump to that conclusion quite so quickly, because I want to focus on this distinction that you're making between Tetra Tech as opposed to a manufacturer slash producer. So in the example you gave of the auto repair, person that brings the car into the shop owns the car, right? And so Tetra Tech is the car owner here, except does it own the car? This is the sludge doesn't belong to Tetra Tech, does it? It's in custody.
We certainly don't own the river or the water in it, but it is tangible personal property in which Tetra Tech is paying SDI to perform a service to. And so that's where the tax comes in.
All right. So your analogy or reference to manufacturers and producers is strictly for the purpose of demonstrating whether or not there was an increase in value to that tangible personal property.
Correct.
Okay.
And the whole purpose of this tax is to tax people that are creating a good or product so it can ultimately be sold or consumed. And we get that from the statute itself and from the department's own rule. And the problem here is that the commission, you know, didn't take any of these factors into account. I mean, the beginning and end of this should have ended with this analysis right here. This is an environmental remediation activity where no good or product is being manufactured or produced. This tax is designed to tax manufacturers and producers. SDI isn't manufacturing or producing anything. They shouldn't be subject to tax. But what did the commission do? It decided to impose the tax for three reasons. And each of these reasons is wrong. It relied on a dictionary. It said that, well, your own people at times referred to this as a process. And third, on this 1998 Hammersley Stone case. And each of those reasons are wrong. I mean, the first is the dictionary definition. And you know, we've been criticized for not providing a dictionary definition. And what we've said is that there's no need here. You look at the context of the statute, which suggests enhancing, improving tangible personal property by a manufacturer or a producer so it can be sold. Then you'll go and look at the department's own rule, which defines it, and again lists examples, all of which are value-enhancing activities. And the department itself says this is only for manufacturers and producers. And manufacturing is when you create a new article of tangible personal property. And then we look at the department's rule definition that they used to put through the steps of a prescribed procedure or to prepare, treat, or convert by subjecting to a special process. I'm not aware of a service that one could provide the tangible personal property that doesn't require the putting it through the steps of a prescribed procedure unless you're randomly doing something to tangible personal property. It would be putting it through the steps of a prescribed procedure.
How did Tetra Tech furnish directly or indirectly the sludge that SDI separated?
Well, Tetra Tech hired Brennan, another subcontractor, to dredge out the river and bring it to SDI.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So here, this definition is completely eviscerated the whole purpose of this statute, which is to only tax services that are specifically and explicitly listed by the legislature. It's supposed to be selective and narrow. Only the taxes, only the services listed are to be taxed. Now the department can turn around and tax anything, because any service that one could do, tangible personal property, the department could say, hey, you put it through the steps of a prescribed procedure here, you're processing something. And so the problem with the dictionary definition used here is that it's just looking at the term processing itself and not putting it in context of the statute in place.
What's your best argument for the word processing? How do we know that it wasn't left intentionally broad? What's your best argument for a narrower construction of the word processing?
I think if you look at the statute itself, so we have the Wisconsin statute on retail sales taxes, that's 77.52 sub 1. Under that statute, the legislature designed it so that all retail sales are subject to tax except for these exceptions. So that's an extremely broad tax. And then what the legislature turned around and did in 2A, which is the tax at issue here, it says only these services can be taxed. And so it purposely chose to make this a limited and selective tax. And if we look at 2A, if we look at how specific the legislature is, I mean, there's dozens of services listed under that statute that are specifically listed. So it's incumbent on the legislature to be specific. That's why this isn't a broad tax. And the problem here is that it's been made improperly broad and completely negated the entire subsection of the statute by use of this definition. And so there might be instances where you need to define a word in a statute, but it needs to be done in the context of the statute. And it needs to be done in you know, there's times where it might be helpful, but not here, not where the statute is to be, you know, narrowly construed and where there's a statute that has all sorts of terms within it that you can help use to discern the meaning of it, or where the department itself has promulgated a rule about what
the speaker's red light is on.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I didn't notice. But thank you, Justice Abraham.
Thank you. I apologize.
No, you don't need to apologize. That's fine. You did a good job, and we will hear from you again in rebuttal. Are you ready to proceed? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Misha Zaitlin, Solicitor General on behalf of the Department of Revenue. Let me begin by clearing up the colloquy that you had, Chief Justice Rogenstein, with counsel. There is absolutely no double taxation here. What happens is that on each sale of a taxable service, there's either a sales tax or a use tax,
right,
and there's never an overlap. Here what happened is for a portion of the period, it was charged as a sales tax for a different to Tetra Tech. For a different portion of a period, it was charged as a use tax to the LLC. So that's why both appear here, but there's no period of double taxation.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
In addition, Your Honor asked us if there were other taxes charged against Tetra Tech, and I think there's an important point to be made there. When Tetra Tech transported the slurry cake at the end of the process to the landfill, that was a service, but that was not taxed because that was not processing. So this notion that everything will be taxed based on our definition is simply false, as shown by the facts of this very case, because transportation is not enumerated, it is not processing, and it is none of the other things enumerated in this provision. Now, if I may, I would like to talk a little bit about the deference issue.
And before you do, the transportation is subject to a process, isn't it? You load it onto trucks, you drive it on streets, you unload it, that's a process.
The way that DOR interprets this provision is to focus on the definition of prepare, treat, or convert. Our study conclusion is that transportation is not preparation, treating, or converting.
And that's because of the dictionary definition.
That's correct, John.
And if a different dictionary used a term that would cover transportation, moving something through a process perhaps, then would the DOR determine that that's taxable as well?
The determination of what the statute means, as I will discuss in the deference portion of my presentation, is for this court. We submit that the court should adopt the definition of processing consistent with that particular dictionary definition, prepare, treat, or convert. There are other dictionary definitions that could be consulted. We think that definition, prepare, treat, or convert, is the proper one to use, and this court should adopt that definition,
okay,
which is consistent with what the TAC did here, the Tax Appeals Commission.
Before you get to your desired argument on deference, I want to be clear what is and is not an issue in this case. Are you in accord with your opposing counsel that there is no dispute that this is tangible personal property?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are you in accord that Tetra Tech is a consumer here?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What are the issues, paraphrased or briefly stated, that you believe exists in this case?
The only issue in dispute between the parties is whether this process, the dewatering, desanding process, qualifies as processing. That is the only issue in dispute. And since we're talking about that, let me just give a little description about the process that happens here. And I think it's hard to describe it as anything but process. What happens is the sludge is transported to SDI by Brennan, which is the other subcontractor. It is then put into various tanks, and then is put through the dewatering and desanding process. That process starts by putting the sludge into a hydrocyclone machine that spins and separates out the sand. Then it is washed and dewatered, and that separates the larger grains of sand. Then it is put into another hydrocyclone machine, again separating out the sand. Then
yeah.
It is again washed.
Mr. Saitlin, and I think this would be a very interesting lesson on how this occurs. But I think Tetra Tech agrees that according to the dictionary definition, what they did does constitute processing, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But they attempt to say that this is some sort of banal separation procedure. And this is actually a quite complicated procedure that falls squarely within that dictionary definition I discussed. It's not... They take sludge in, and then you get three things out. You get the sand, you get the slurry cake, and you get the water. I think the parties are in agreement that, for example, if the process involved the crushing of rocks into asphalt, which was the case that was the Hammersley Stone case,
mm-hmm.
and also crushing rocks is listed in that regulation. They concede that is processing. I would submit that crushing rocks into smaller rocks is, if anything, less processing than taking this complicated multi-step process that takes one piece of sludge and turns it into three separate things, some of which potentially can be reused.
Right. So, but would you agree with Tetra Tech that crushing those rocks into smaller rocks so they could be used in paving activities makes the rocks more valuable?
It may or may not make them more valuable. They may have value as large rocks. Obviously, the company who requested the rock crushing wanted smaller rocks.
Right.
Just like Tetra Tech here wanted those three components.
But
well,
don't they make something? I mean, when you crush rocks, don't you make gravel? Gravel is different than a great big chunk of rock. So aren't you making something by the crushing of the rocks? When I try to figure out what the statute means, I see a number of terms, and producing is only one of the terms in a string of terms. So I look at, well, what does producing mean? Well, you're saying that they were processing, right?
That's right.
Okay, so producing, you're producing gravel if you have a big rock, so you're making something. What does fabricating mean? Well, you know, if you're a fabricator, maybe you're a steel fabricator, so you're going to make widgets, so you're making something. And if you're processing milk, you could make cheese, right? And if you're printing something, then you're making a document that's printed. And if you're imprinting something, you're changing the form of what you had before into a different type of article. So why shouldn't I look at all those and say, processing. Well, separating things into three parts isn't making anything. So why shouldn't I say that processing doesn't fit because of that?
Well, you think about the crushing rocks example. You had something big,
yep.
and you had something smaller, and the smaller things were more valuable to the company. Here, you had slurry cake,
right.
and you get three things out of it. One of them is sand. which in this particular case, Tetra Tech chose to donate to the Department of Transportation, but they didn't have to do that. They could have sold the sand. They could have done anything they wanted with the sand. There's no requirement here that you kind of look on the follow-on and to see what value they got. And in fact, they did get substantial value even out of the separation services because of their commercial endeavor that led to the discharge of PCBs in the Fox River. They had to do something. They had to take it out, and they got three things out of it, and they wanted all three things. What they wanted all three things for, that's not the concern of the tax code, and that's not the concern of the tax appeals commission.
Did they really want all three things, or did they separate into three parts because then they can just put... The object was to clean up the Fox River, okay? So they get the slurry out, and they put the water back in the Fox River where they took it from, but they didn't really want the water, did they?
That may be true, Your Honor. But that is because of whatever provisions they violated under the federal CERCLA. Mm-hmm. The bottom line from the point of view of looking at the service, mm-hmm. the service is taking sludge and giving back three things, which is what the customer wants. Regardless of whether the customer believes asphalt is valuable to them, regardless of whether the customer believes sand is valuable to them, regardless of whether the customer believes that gravel is valuable to them, mm-hmm. that's not the interest of the tax. So the question is, does it fit into the definition of processing? And I will also note that they have not provided any coherent definition of processing. All they do is look at this regulation that was referenced here. Yeah. The regulation unambiguously says that these are just examples. And I would note that a couple of the examples, not only the crushing rock one, but one of them is cleaning oil. That is very close to what's going on here, and they don't dispute that cleaning oil would fall into the definition of processing. So therefore, since they don't dispute that, and if this court does not accept their, I think, completely unsupported argument that that list is comprehensive and exclusive, which clearly is not because it's labeled examples, and then it says including.
Well, you know, I see that. I think they're focusing more on the whole section of the administrative code, which applies only to processing and manufacturing, and they're saying SDI isn't a processor or a manufacturer as that section of the administrative code. So I think that's kind of what they're focusing on. I'm more concerned with interpreting the statute, mm-hmm. frankly, and it's nice to use a dictionary, but... A dictionary may never have been used by the legislature when they put this together, so we have to figure out what does the statute mean, and what's your best argument when you look at the string of terms that are contained in the statute that what is done here in this separation process is processing, and make that term fit within the others that are in the statute. So what string would you hook them together by? I told you I would hook them by they're making something. That's how it seems to me, but... What would you hook them together with so that processing means what you're arguing to us that it means?
Well, Your Honor, I think that this court has repeatedly looked to dictionary definitions.
I know. I get the argument. That's not what I want to hear. I read your brief. It's a good brief, okay? I want you to help me a little bit with these words because obviously I'm trying to make sense of all of them in a string. And if I asked you to do that, which that's what I'm doing... How would you define the commonality of that string of terms in the statute?
I think the commonality is providing services to tangible property that's provided. So we have producing and fabricating. That's what they focused on. But you also have printing. You have imprinting. So these are various things that can be done to property that is brought to you that wouldn't include transporting because that doesn't have any sort of change in the article. Yes. But here... We have something quite different. We have preparing, treating, or converting. And so I'm not saying that the court should adopt the dictionary definition because it's in the dictionary. I'm saying that those terms, prepare, treat, and convert, line up with the other terms that are listed in the statute, producing, fabricating, printing. That's my submission, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're saying the dictionary definition would fit on any of these. So if you looked up fabricating, you would end up with the same commonality of terms as you get for producing?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that if you broke down producing into that definition that we are submitting,
right,
which
right.
is prepare, treat, or convert,
right, right.
that would fit well in the list of produce, fabricate, imprint, prepare, treat, and convert.
Well, I wonder if I get my law clerk to do that for me and look up each of those in the dictionary if we're going to find a commonality of terms. But that's a good answer, and I will check it out.
What I hear Chief Justice Rogenczyk talking to you about is the associated words canon.
Right, Your Honor.
And assuming that there's a common thread that weaves all of these various words together. And I heard your answer in that regard. Sometimes, though, statutes are to be construed broader in that they have a series of words that come together. And then, for example, processing could be a very broad word intended to encompass a lot of different things not specifically listed in that statute. Usually, those kinds of words belong at the end, when they're going through a string and then want to include much more. What do you think of the canons of construction, and what canons work best for your argument here today?
Right, Your Honor. So we've cited cases for this court, including the Paolo Waski case, where you have a list of terms with or in between them. They are often overlapping, and they can often be broad. And this notion that the broader term would be at the end, that's not how this particular statute is structured. If you look at the immediately prior subsection, subsection 10, I think it's very clear that the broadest term in that list, service, repair, alteration, cleaning, painting, is service. That word appears second. So I think the fact that processing, which is obviously the broadest term in 11A, appears third rather than fifth, doesn't tell us much, given that the broadest word in 10 is service, and that appears second.
You know, I'm sort of curious. Imprinting and printing don't really have different definitions. Why do you think the legislature chose to include both of those phrases in this statute? And did they intentionally, what did they do with respect, do you think, the idea that there shouldn't be surplusage?
Right, Your Honor. I think it shows that the terms here between 10 and 11 are often overlapping. And we see this, for example, in the Hammersley-Stone case, which both parties cite. There, the term, the crushing of the rock, was considered both alteration under 10 and processing under 11. There are many other cases where the services at issue were covered under two terms in 10 or two terms at 11. So I think there's clearly overlap in some of these terms. And I think there is no way to read the term processing but broadly, because it only has capacious definitions.
Counsel, can we get to deference?
Yes, sir.
Only if you're satisfied that he's answered your question, though.
I think he's working on it.
Okay. Yeah. Please finish, and then let's get to the deference.
Justice Bradley, I had one final question on that, if I could.
Well, I think
Justice Ziegler. Are you done with answering me, or do you have a little more to go?
That was your answer, that was my answer, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
All right. So, Mr. Saitlin, you say that there is some overlap and acceptable overlap between processing and other terms. But let's take a look at the companion verbs in subpart 11. Is there any act of producing that would not involve the process?
Sorry, Your Honor, I missed that. Could you?
Sure. Again? Is there the first verb in subpart 11 is producing, right? So we've got the producing, fabricating, processing, printing, or imprinting tangible property. Is there any kind of producing that could take place with respect to tangible property that was not a process?
If you are creating something new and you're just taking a little piece and you're making it as part of a big piece, you're producing something much larger and you're just taking the tangible piece of property and just plugging it in as part of a machine, that might not be processing, that might be just producing, because that wouldn't be the preparing, treating, or converting of the small, tangible piece that you put into some bigger machine. You're not doing anything with that machine.
Might be converting it into a bigger machine.
Well, you're not converting that thing. You're not doing anything with that thing. And to the extent this court wants to something more limiting, I think that's to look at the commonality of the definition prepare, treat, convert. You have to do something to the thing that comes in.
Okay. Is there any kind of fabricating that you can do with respect to tangible personal property that would not involve a process?
I think my answer to that would be similar. If your fabrication involved not converting, treating, or that particular thing, the tangible piece of property at issue, then it would not. But if you're doing something to the actual thing, for example, you're breaking it up into gravel, or you are separating into three things, or you're cleaning oil off it, like another example, then it would be, in fact, processing.
Can we get to deference, unless someone else wants to
ask? I just want to know, is there anything in the Court of Appeals decision that you disagree with?
No, I think the Court of Appeals got it exactly right. On this issue, obviously,
right.
they apply great
That's
weight deference.
That's right. That's why I wanted the question answered before we get to that.
Justice Bradley, please.
Yes. You started out saying you wanted to talk about deference. I, unfortunately, asked you a different question. So let's get to your argument on deference. You seem to have a kind of, from my mind, a novel approach, a novel in terms of the way that we've looked thus far at the law. So take it away, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Applying great weight deference in Chapter 227 cases violates two separation of powers principles. First, it violates the court's duty to say what the law is. But second, it violates the legislature's authority to prescribe the extent of judicial review.
That's what I mean by novel. You're kind of joining your opposing counsel. Give me your alternative. What do you want? Because we heard their argument already why this is dastardly. But give me your solution.
With respect, Your Honor, I think the solution has already been provided by the legislature. In 227.57 sub 10, the legislature did not provide for anything like great weight deference. It provided for due weight commensurate with the experience, technical competence, specialized knowledge, and the discretion conferred upon the agency. That adopted the common law rule before Chapter 227 was enacted, going back to cases in the 1870s here. And we submit that that instruction is not only consistent with the common law, it's also consistent with what the legislature said, and that would solve the puzzle of deference by simply applying the statute as written. Now, with regard to great weight...
Yeah, with respect to that due weight, as it appears in 227.57, I was puzzling over on how we are supposed to apply that. So you say that does not mean deference to the agency's interpretation of the statute. It means giving respect to the agency's views in light of their experience, technical competence, and specialized knowledge. What does it mean practically as we're writing an opinion? We say we give respect to the agency's views. What effect does that have on the decision that we reach?
I think the court should do what the courts were doing before Chapter 227 was enacted, like in the Harrington case. You go through the canons of statutory construction, and then as one of the inputs in the decision, as part of the court's all things considered judgment as to what the statute means. If you have a very technical term that the agency is expert in interpreting, if you have a broad term such that it looks like that there was some discretion conferred upon the agencies, that would be an input into the decision. It is fundamentally different from great weight deference, where the question has changed. The question has changed from what does the statute mean to is this so far outside the bounds of reasonableness that we're going to strike it down. Here, the court for itself is determining what it means. But when you have something technical and an expert agency has interpreted, or you have something broad and the agency has been delegated some authority by the legislature, then you would take that into account as part of your constitutional authority and responsibility to say what the law is.
Right. So we always take into account, just so you know, we always take into account the party's views of the statutes and what they mean. Are we supposed to account more for an agency's view of what the statute means than the opponent's view?
Yes, Your Honor, if the agency is exercising its specialized knowledge of technical competence and if there's been amount of discretion conferred upon the agency by the legislature, because, of course, we're trying to determine what the legislature means.
Okay, so this would be a question of persuasion rather than the agency's view of the law controlling our decision.
Well, right, Your Honor. It would be an input in your decision. For example, in this case, the Tax Appeals Commission is not before Your Honor. We have the Tax Appeals Commission's views. We're not asking you to give us, the Department of Revenue, any due weight. We're in our status as a party or in any way. We are asking for due weight to the Tax Appeals Commission because it was exercising its technical judgment, because it's been conferred a decent amount of discretion by the statutes. So that is an input into the decision-making process. And I think a good example of that is, I think, in the utilities amicus brief, which is the only party here that kind of defended a great way deference. But I think the utilities amicus brief can be folded well into the construct that the legislature actually set up. They're concerned about statutes in the utilities context that talk about unreasonable rates. And they say, well, the utility regulators, they have a lot of expertise, a lot of knowledge. They've been given some leeway in this area. Well, when you have something like what is an unreasonable rate, that's not something that kind of defines itself. And in determining during a Chapter 227 review whether a rate is unreasonable, I think it would be quite sensible to consult among the all things considered judgment what the regulators in this area have said about it.
Right. So now that would be a difference, though, wouldn't it, between affording deference to their exercise of discretion as opposed to their interpretation of a statute, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the statute provides four things that go into how much weight is due. The last one is discretion. The first three go into judgment and expertise and things of that sort. So I think those are all in the equation.
Right, but your reference was to the Utilities Commission setting a rate, and that is. Specifically an exercise of discretion, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But in addition, if you could imagine a situation where the rate setting or something comparable was not a technical definition. It was something more banal, more prosaic. In that circumstance, you would have the last factor satisfied, which is a significant amount of discretion conferred upon the agency. But some of the other factors might not weigh as strongly because it's not technical, it's not specialized. So that is the way that it would operate following the statute.
Counsel, is the statute at issue here that we've all talked about, the taxing statute, ambiguous, or is it plain on its face?
I think there is no ambiguity in the term processing. I think it means what the dictionary definition says. However, if the court thinks there is ambiguity, which I've heard that there are some views from the bench on that, I think at that point it is valuable to consult the other statute, which is sub 10.
Mm-hmm.
And in consulting that, you should look that there is a decent amount of expertise here from the Tax Appeals Commission. I mean, it goes back to the Hammersley-Stone decision, which both parties cite. And I also think it's quite telling that even though my friends on the other side say that the court should blind itself to what the commission says, peppered throughout their brief are citations to old commission decisions.
Just because a word is broad doesn't mean it's ambiguous, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, it's important whether it's ambiguous or not, because this is a taxing statute, and any ambiguity is often construed against the taxing authority and in favor of the taxpayer, right?
That's right, Your Honor, but I think I want to refine that principle a little.
But if it's not ambiguous, do we get to what kind of deference would we do?
I think that this court can, as the majority did in Overton, avoid the deference issue if it wanted. However, in the vast majority of cases where this court has reviewed agency decisions, it talks about the deference issue first and addresses how you're going to review it, and then it decides. And I think given that the deference issue has now been fully briefed before the court, as Your Honor suggested in your separate opinion in Overton, the interested parties have come in and have laid it out for the court. I think it would be valuable to agencies and to litigants to have this court's word, especially when this court has only in the Racine decision, this court even discuss subsection 10. And
talk to me about processing. I go back to you're hearing varied views on what it could mean, but couldn't it be that the legislature just intended it to be very broad? I mean, I did a brief search of the word process and processing in the statutes. I think it came up 500 and some, almost 600 times. There are times in other parts of the statutes where the legislature, you know, defines what meat processing is or food processing or, you know, different issues. with respect to processing and then provides a definition. Legislature didn't do that here, so maybe it's their job to fix it if they didn't intend it to be broad. What do you think of that?
I think that's absolutely right, Your Honor. And I know there's been a little bit of pushback on using the dictionary definition. When the legislature doesn't define a term in the statute, what you usually do, including in tax statutes, is you look at the dictionary. And also on that canon that was referenced earlier about don't we say it's no tax if there's ambiguity, that canon is a little more refined than that. There has to be a definition, there has to be an alternate definition on the other side. Here, we have not had an alternate definition proposed different than the dictionary by anyone. The taxpayers were criticized by the Circuit Court about this. They were criticized by the Court of Appeals about this, and they continue not to provide an alternative definition because there isn't a coherent definition of processing where the complicated multi-step process of separating slurry into sand, filter cake, and water is not processing.
You know, counsel, one question that comes to mind on the great issue here about the constitutionality of deference, just my, based on my reading of all three cases today, as you know, have something to do with it. And thinking and listening to the argument, a question comes to my mind, and that is this. From a constitutional perspective, what is the difference between an agency who has a dog in the fight, and that we need to remember that the same agency that's interpreting the rules has a dog in the fight. They're not some disinterested lawgiver, and that's it. They have an interest in the contest. From a constitutional perspective as to why the courts should defer to the interpretations of that agency which has an interest in the outcome of the case, what is the difference between our instructing courts to defer to the judgment and the interpretation of agencies who have experience and who have knowledge about the law and who have a particular body of law, as opposed to, say, a law firm or a public interest law firm, which says we're going to develop a practice based solely on Wisconsin taxation issues. And we are going to build up, and that's all we're going to do. We're not going to take any other kinds of cases. We're going to build it up, and we're going to issue learned treatises, and we are going to bring in scholars, and we are going to issue interpretations based on the cases that we have fought and that others have fought, and all of our observations, and we're going to have a lot of experience with litigation and a lot of experience advising individuals and companies and other collective groups. And if they came to us and said, well, we're learned, we're experienced, we have experience interpreting all of these, I don't want you to say a factual difference, that they're not charged with promulgating rules. We know that. But from a constitutional perspective, what's the difference?
Right, Your Honor. I have two answers to that.
And remember, I don't want a factual difference.
Right. Well, so it is not always true that the agency has a dog in the fight. For example, may I finish?
Yes, please.
In this case, the Tax Appeals Commission is an arbiter between the taxpayers. But in those cases, the difference is that the legislature in subsection 10 used its own constitutional authority, as Justice Sykes said for the court in the Beecher decision, to prescribe the extent of review. So there's a constitutional difference because the legislature itself has a constitutional authority to prescribe the extent of review in agency cases.
Okay. Thank you for your answer.
Thank you very much.
I think Chief Justice asked a question or made a statement that said that you were interested in interpreting the statute, and we are too. And I think the department's argument here, the beginning and end of it, is that when you interpret a statute, you simply pull out a dictionary. And that's not the case. There are far more useful tools than a dictionary to help courts interpret statutes.
What's the interpretation of the word process or processing that you proffered?
Well, there's no need to define the term because the term is defined itself in the context of the statute and the department's own rule on it.
Okay, but what is that definition, that it's defined itself? What's the definition?
Well, sure. There is actually a dictionary definition that supports our position that this is a manufacturing and producing type activity. The Cambridge Dictionary, for instance, defines it as the series of actions that are taken to change raw materials during the production of goods.
Then you're just doing the same thing, and I thought you were advancing that. Nope, shouldn't use a dictionary definition.
There is no need to use a dictionary definition.
Here so what's your definition absent a dictionary definition?
Our definition is that it's taking a tangible personal property in a manufacturing and producing context and enhancing it or creating some sort of or doing some sort of value-enhancing service to it. Not separating out materials into its component parts so that they can be hauled off to a hazardous landfill for disposal.
So, counsel, if we took the dictionary definition proposed by the Department of Revenue and we added your piece that creates commercial value to the property, would that satisfy you?
That would satisfy me a lot more than the definition currently used because it can be used to tax any service to tangible personal property.
And the justification for adding the adds commercial value, the justification for adding that to the definition is because that's what the companion verbs in the statute do.
Both the statute and the department's own promulgated rule on it in tax 1138. Yes, absolutely. And so these tools of statutory interpretation that are available to a court, and keep in mind, if the statute's ambiguous and you're turning to these tools of statutory interpretation, under this particular taxing statute, all ambiguity and doubt is to be construed against taxation. But if we look at these other tools that are available to the court, you know, we have the legislative intent of the statute. We have, which we've talked about, that this is a narrow tax and selective that's to be construed narrowly. We have the context where the term appears. We've talked about that at great length. We've looked to the third tool is looking to see if it's defined elsewhere, and it is in 1138. And the fourth tool is to interpret it in such a way as to avoid surplusage. Counsel gave an example as to why, you know, producing might not be processing. And I think the example they gave, and I'm paraphrasing, is, you know, if you take a material and you a widget and you stick it in an object in the creation of a larger thing, well, their definition is to put through the steps of a prescribed procedure. There's steps of a prescribed procedure there. You pick up the widget, you insert it properly in order for it to work. I mean, there is nothing that's not tangible, that's not processing under their definition. It completely negates the text. And that's not the purpose of this statute. There's also some reference to the Hammersley-Stone case. The Hammersley-Stone case is distinguishable for a couple reasons. First, there the taxpayers conceded that processing was, that they were engaged in processing. The issue was whether or not it was at retail. And in Hammersley-Stone, you're right, they crushed big rocks into little rocks.
Well, that's an example also that's given in the administrative rule.
It's also an example, correct. And here, what they didn't do in Hammersley is take the rocks and separate it into all its component mineral parts to then have certain parts hauled off to a landfill. I mean, there was a commercial purpose to that activity there. And so it's completely different than what happened here. And so if you look at these other tools of statutory interpretation that are available to the court, they all weigh heavily in favor against taxation.
Counsel, in looking at sub 11, and the words that you are focusing on, I look at the word imprinting of tangible property or items. Why does that necessarily convey to you a requirement that the imprinting must add commercial value? I mean, I think imprinting something could not. I have no idea.
Well, here we look to the department's own rule on it, 1138, and it says there that processing is limited to manufacturers and producers. And so while imprinting and printing might be different, here the department has promulgated its own rule on it that says that processing itself is limited to that sort of activity.
And you're referring, of course, to 11.38, what subsection?
The entire subsection.
Fabricating, processing, and printing is the title of it.
Thank you, Counsel.
Is there no specific subsection?
He just said sub 11.
Subsection 1138. If you look at the heading of that subchapter, it's fabricating, processing, and printing. And then it's sub 2, examples of fabricating and processing services.
Yeah, okay. I have that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is very interesting. You know, you are a series of three cases today where we're looking at some things that they've been doing for a long time, which is giving deference to agencies' decisions at several levels. And I appreciate your help in our trying to work through that issue as well as the issues that are very particularized to reviewing a Tax Appeals Commission decision. So thank you. The briefs were very good. And the oral argument was also very good. So thank you so much. We're going to take a break now so that the students can leave and perhaps others may come into the courtroom. We are adjourned.